visually focused. Ooh, that one. And to start off, we all have this document on the ethical visualization workflow. So this is a progression of the work that is listed in our, or detailed in our article on the two historical lynching visualizations. For a bit of background about this, you'll see in the bottom right-hand corner there's a version control number, and I'm basically updating this since we published the article as I'm doing new research and talking to new people about these ideas and integrating what I learn. I'm on sabbatical right now and my research activities are pretty much full-time on this, so interesting things are coming up from various historical archives and teaching and research group opportunities. But before I go into the kind of principles of how to do this, let me go through a little bit of background of how I got here. So most of my work is really concerned with how do we and how can we visualize or study the power relationships in visualizations and in visual material. So in my graduate studies, one of the big questions was, is it possible to find evidence of historical power relations in visual materials? And the really short answer is yes. So I used a governmentality framework, like a lot of the critical geography, critical infoviz scholars that we've seen some readings for. I'm very influenced by Foucault in this work, and particularly a governmentality framework because of the ability to look at kind of remote webs of power distribution that have very significant felt effects, but are not like a hard power chain of command style. So in terms of governmentality in the political science literature about it, there's so many visual descriptions and use of the words like diagrams, where people are thinking about visual qualities as being a way that these power relations are engendered, but there's not a core body of visual expertise, right, in the discipline. So working in a design school, I took on this challenge, and then within governmentality, there's talk about technologies of government being instruments of this kind of, so how this power is executed. And then within that, there's descriptions of a kind of taxonomic idea of forces, techniques, and then devices. Devices being the smallest unit of a technology of government. And so using this model, I attempted to find evidence of power relations as discourses embodied in the visual materials. So this is an example of my sample set. So I had in the final set 298 seals, logos, and crests. So there's one of each up there that represented governments from English settlement to 2000 in my data set. And then taking this forces, techniques, devices, created technologies of, so broke it down into a faceted classification. So having the technologies of form, technologies of content, and then having areas where they overlap. So like facets that connect the two. And then this is the final, the listing of every facet in the classification. And then these were used to basically map onto, this is like the final analysis, was that we can find the visual evidence maps quite closely to the written record of the history of governance in this area during this time, but that the visual evidence supplements a little bit. So these are all existing ideology is well discovered and written about in the literature. These are discourse technologies that I identified from the facets of devices, techniques and forces, and then the embodied discourses was like a linking kind of category between the two. So what I've discovered from yesterday is that this all seems very measurable and traceable and very similar to some of the problems that you're working on, particularly David, with text and that idea of how do you... I didn't know this was able to be so empirically studied until yesterday, seeing those kind of nuanced examples of how you explained the, like, you can identify a person as a very vague description of a person can still be identified. I think you can do the same thing with these visual elements, which is really exciting. This relates to the ethics because we use the framework I developed for studying these power relations in an historical analysis way for the workflow that we proposed in the analysis of these two. So when we're looking at power structures, basically this early research of mine suggests, yes, the power structures are implicit, studyable, measurable, they have these effects, and we can't escape them. We can, however, move the needle on them, right? So we can direct them in ways, we can consciously direct them if we're aware of them. So when I talk about ethical visualization generally, not to computer scientists and people very interested in power relations, the simplest way I find to talk about it and communicate effectively about it is in terms of argumentation. So it's pretty similar concept and referring to rhetoric as well. So in terms of visualizations, very similar thing can happen in terms of identifying these kind of levels of forces, forces, techniques, and devices. But I talk about it in general about explicit argumentation and implicit argumentation. So explicit is more the things that we're used to seeing in text, things like titles. So the title, of course, changing the framing, the visualization. And so here we have an example from the Data Feminisms book. So different heading and subheading framing the data. Then captions, of course. So in this example, the captions are replacing the text in each interaction effect, guiding and heavily annotating the experience of the user. So then in terms of ethical visualization, I would argue that that mitigates the potential for harm if you're educating the user during the interaction journey. Then annotations in the text, so emphasizing the things that matter, that should matter to your audience given the parameters of what you're most interested in. Then emphases, so the use of, say in this example, one color as, so one color that stands out from the others because that's the thing you want to draw the eye to. So these are super basic concepts in information design, fairly rarely executed in online visualization and particularly in DH projects. Implicit argumentation is less well known, and that's more coming from this technologies of government aspect as well. But they're also known in human factors design, they're talked about a little bit in different language and also in data science. So scale, of course, so you can make anything look insignificant by reducing the scale. And then this is striking because it's the same data as the previous Bloomberg report on climate change. Far harder to understand, right? Because there's not the annotation. Categorization, so how you define your categories and how you name them, obviously having a huge priming effect. So priming being how you subliminally or unconsciously prepare people to receive the message you're about to give them. So data breaks, so it's very, people interpret a lot, a surprising amount of meaning into the data breaks that you give them the option for. So for example, the data breaks can also be a tool of communicating different extra information that is not necessarily like a legend is something that's often thought of as an after effect, but you see in the case of Munro work today here, we have the categories of lynched historical subjects includes Black, Italian, Native American, Latin, X, and other, and Chinese. So this is communicating there are these broad groups of people who were lynched, right? So it's having this furthering the argument effect that is countering a widespread and incorrect narrative that lynching was perpetrated by white Americans on African American. Right. And then priming, more classically, image and color associations. So the journalist who created this graph openly admits, you know, kind of Twitter controversy about it, that she was inspired by Dripping Blood, right? So this is a extreme case, but there's other, yeah, I know. and again, all of the cultural contextual factors related to color and priming. So an example from Nigel Holmes, who is a great information designer and has done great work. He's also done a lot of terrible work that is great to use for examples. And then nudges, so how you guide the user through your visualizations, whether you do, how much you do, the level of interaction effects. So like we talked about in the article, Racism in the Machine, the kind of four levels of interaction effects of depth, and then the very limited interaction effects in the EJI chart suggest that that's all you need to know to the user. So there's these suggestions from the experience that reinforce a particular argument that that I argue, if you're not consciously crafting, is working against you and very likely working against your user and doing the opposite of what you want. Yeah. So this is the depth that you can go to in the interaction effects there. And then of course sizing and proportional link. So the size of the icons that you use matters. Comparisons of icons, using icons of different sizes, is very misleading, obviously. Little less well known, or little less well thought of, is the sizing of icons relative to your data. So in this example, for example, how long are these cars? Too long. They are monster cars.
6 meters, yeah?
Yeah. Or?
The red car is about
80 meters.
Exactly. Yeah. So, in terms of the ethical visualization, some critiques of data science and discussions around ethics and computational methods have called for a do no harm Hippocratic oath for working with data. So this is one of the first, one of the earliest Hippocratic Oath versions. So practice two dealings in your things in your dealings with disease, either help or do not harm the patient. So for visualizations, I'm proposing that you either help or do not harm the user. And so in terms of do not harm, that's where this comes in. So we identify three groups. So do no harm to peers or users, which includes yourself when you're doing visualization for your own analysis, your own insight, to your represented subjects, and then subjects impacted by the representation. So subjects impacted by the representation includes, for example, on issues of climate change, arguably everyone. On issues of like a historical data set of lynching in the US, arguably all Americans, but particularly descendants of represented people. Yeah. So in terms of help the user, so embracing the argument. So that's where we get into the workflow. So it comes, so because of this idea that all visual communication is has these power structures, these hugely rhetorical qualities, and I would argue more so than text, and in a more dangerous way than text, because there's this truth effect going on with visualizations where they have so much cultural loading as being objective, as being authoritative, as being true, in a way that we have more inherent skepticism of text. It's a less culturally likely thing for us to read a sentence and go, that's definitely true, right? Than with a chart. So right from the very beginning of research questions in terms of exploring data, I'm arguing that having a design approach of deciding what behavior or attitude you want to change. So what your goal is in terms of who your audience is, what belief or attitude you want to change. So this really moves away from the idea of like exploring data, playing with data for its own sake. Those are activities that are perfectly fine and ethical to encourage for people, but really I'm arguing the ethical thing to do is to have in mind particular goals that you want. If you want to shift the needle on X, what would that be and why? And then defining an argument outside of your visualization, so before visualizing. And then going to the literature and the data processes that we've talked about a lot yesterday that I don't need to go into for you. And then reviewing ethics and refining the argument in the visualization stage, I should say. One thing that's come up that Doris and I talked about yesterday is the importance of hand instrument iterations, so sketching either like digitally or with hand pencil. I'm finding seems to be coming up more and more as a really important part of ethically visualizing, like early on having pencil and paper models. Do you want to talk a little bit about that with the computer science?
Yeah, we had an example in this project of energy visualization, mm-hmm. and we began with first of all, choosing personas.
Mm-hmm.
So we make like a, in a group like that, we make an exercise and organize a small groups within a major group,
mm-hmm.
and decide one or two personas. And then we began to sketch for this persona in mind, because it helps. I'm not particularly fond of personas, but I think it helps you to project for somebody else, not yours.
Mm.
I think this is the point. And when you sketch, you have other points to talk about and to discuss the point.
So it's a thinking tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the end, you can use it. If something came up, show up, very nice idea, you can use it and develop it further.
Yeah, but that's not the primary function.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
No. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's more like to fix the idea, to fix the point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll be very useful in this project, because I think this project has a huge challenge that is being ethical over a core that is all biased. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It has all distorted and ideas on race and so on. So it will be tough to show what you have, but not showing that you don't agree with that.
Right.
Not changing it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, the other point I thought was, because when you have a huge number of filters in a visualization, it's not possible to check all of them until it's ready. So how can we think ethically when you don't have all the measures, or you can't domain all the aspects, because some issues will emerge in the interaction itself.
Yeah, and so we've talked quite a bit about user testing and the importance of user testing. What we haven't talked about that much is the expense and feasibility of user testing.
And also because a user testing with the real data, it's when everything is ready. So I wonder if you really need it after you have all ready. So. Yeah. Because relating it to the data, once you put the real data there, you can do some easy tests before you have everything ready, or in paper with part of the data.
Yeah. So those are the questions we have based on your expertise and experience in the room. What do you notice as, I guess, issues of feasibility, or would be ideal to have in terms of an ethical visualization, or particular aspects of it, maybe certain computational areas of the process? Yes.
Well, I would love to establish a little bit of a baseline first. So do you have examples of ways in which you see this ethical process intersecting with the data in the journal that we talked about yesterday?
Yes.
Like what would that look like?
So in terms of, so we're using this kind of approach during every stage.
Yeah.
So like asking the question, so now,
So there's kind of two examples just from the prototype. One, the map projection that we used, which is already centered in the Atlantic and is going to privilege any sort of visualization that puts North America and kind of Western Europe. That's going to be where your eye goes first.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of it, which we talk about in the comparison between EJI and Monroe Work Today, the EJI one, by using a chloropleth map, has decided that the political boundaries of the state, and more specifically the political boundaries of a county, are important, which implicitly suggests and invites the user to make comparisons. And so what people will wind up doing with Google's EJI map is say, my county has clean hands, or my county is a lighter shade of red than the one next door, or Georgia fared far worse than X, Y, or Z. Right, and that is a fundamentally unethical reading, in my estimation, of the data, because what you're doing is missing the point, which is how widespread this is, and instead localizing it in a way that it really wasn't localized. And so in the prototype, because I had made the choice to make bins to try to aggregate the data in a way that would be that would account for the fact that there might be 30 cities that are mentioned, and I really want to show that they're all from the same place, what happens is you end up inviting kind of potentially false comparisons between, in this case, an entirely arbitrary region on a map. But we could decide, if we aggregated by modern political boundaries, now you're drawing comparisons between, if we were to look at the problem of Siam, right? So are you going to pick Indochina as a region and then shade it, or are you going to do it by the modern day political boundaries? I mean, these are all real problems when it comes to how the user receives it, because if you're doing it in a chloropleth fashion like that, people are going to want to say, well, my place got mentioned more, got mentioned less, you know, the racism against this particular target people, depending on how we visualize it, was more heinous than this, or, and then even in our class at DHSI, we'll start students off and we actually have them take data and twist it. And some of them are skeptical on day one, because we'll give them a data set, they'll go, well, I don't know. And then within, like, by the second day, they've made graphs out of that same data using the same techniques that show the complete opposite of what the scholar who made the data set had concluded from it. And so that's what we're trying to mitigate and control for, so that we're not, we give them too much play with filters. There's a 538 one where you can pick your, was it p-hacking, where you can take and you can completely flip which way, that based on which filters and parameters that you check. We don't want that to happen. But the other side, we don't want to make a map like EJI's that is so shallow and so focused on the way they want it, because it's, the EJI one is connected to trying to draw an association between lynching and modern day incarceration rates in the American South. And so that's their focus. And by doing that, though, by making it that shallow and chloroplast, they're inviting all of these other associations that really are contrary to their goal. So kind of figuring out that depth and plasticity of the visualization is a tricky one.
Mm-hmm.
A very long-winded answer to, I think, the question. Yeah, so this, you can take the filters on the left there with the same exact data and show a positive correlation that's publishable with an accepted p-value, or a negative correlation with an accepted p-value, just by changing which factors in a multivariate analysis that you include. And so if we do that with, even if it's purely subjective data, and the visualization's that plastic, people could really distort what that information is trying to show.
Is it a real fear?
Is it a real fear?
Yeah. Why is it? Because if researchers access your data,
mm-hmm.
you can access any data and make a mess of it. And even if you, I've done research on annual reports, the diagrams in annual reports. I took the 200 best designed annual reports for a competition in the Netherlands in the year 2000. And about half of them, about 100, use graphs, diagrams inside financial reports. And these are companies like Philips, Shell, Royal, whatever it is, the very big ones. The conclusion is basically, if an annual report shows a diagram, do not buy shares in that company, because they lie. One third overestimated or underestimated the data based on incompetence of graphic designers to visualize the financial data. Out of the one third, about a sixth overemphasized and 5/6 underemphasized. Basically, complete incompetence, because graphic designers are not trained to make these things. So, based on that, and you can make any diagram in any form, you can distort it in any way you like. That's something from a negative point of view, that people can do it.
Mm-hmm.
People will. Mm-hmm. But from a research point of view, let's start from the positive side. Let's make the data available, warn people, point them to things that actually distort the data in unacceptable ways. Say, look, be careful with our data. This is what we got. It is biased, it's incorrect, it is colonial, it is all the way around, wrong way around, but this is what we got. Use that to visualize, please, but make sure that you use ethical guidelines without a fable.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with that approach, you know, of making the data available and giving the caveats is, I was talking with some of you yesterday about the example of interactive sea level rise viewers, which are geographic visualization tools for visualizing climate data for government agencies and individuals to decide on their level of risk in relation to sea level rise, particularly in at-risk areas like Norfolk in Virginia and areas in Florida. And very much this approach of here's the data, here's the filters, be careful with it, it's, you know, you have to know what you're doing with it. So the overall goal of these tools is to help people make decisions more in their interests related to climate change data. If they have the access to the data, they'll make better decisions, is like the logic behind them.